Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And today on the show, a bunch of delightful things,
yeah,
I have to say.
It really is.
Looking forward to hearing about your experience at the JFK Arboretum in New Ross in Ireland. So a little bit more of Bob's summer travels to Ireland. I've been there, so at least I'll have a snapshot in my head as you revisit it and kind of bring it freshly back to my memory.
Yeah, I had a wonderful hostess. Her name was Mairead Carbra, mm-hmm. and she's a little bit of a wisp of a woman with a great passion for plants. Mm-hmm. I bet she's not even 5 feet tall. But she led us around, but mostly she told stories connected to the trees.
Oh, yeah?
So it's not so much going to be about the plants you'll find, but the stories, the heritage, mm-hmm. the little people, the mm-hmm. druids, all those things that float around Ireland all the time. And then, kind of poignantly, since with the death of Ted Kennedy, we went to the Kennedy Homestead, which is just down the road from the JFK Arboretum. Mm-hmm. It's a neat place because it's run by one great grandson, and it's kind of low-key, and the estate should be neon signs and billboards, mm-hmm. but this kid is kind of low-key and soft and fun, but the original buildings that were there when Patrick left in 1848, the first Kennedy, are still there.
Wow.
So you kind of go in there and you look around and look for the ghosts. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it's a good trip. We had a great time.
Sounds really great, Bob. Look forward to hearing that in the second part of the show. First, we're going to talk with Joe Eck. He and his partner, Wayne Winterroad, have penned a new book together called Our Life in Gardens. A little bit of memoir, a little bit of gardening advice. But it's, some people just can write.
Oh, yeah.
And they both write so beautifully, lyrically, so clearly, you could sit down and, you know, each little essay has a theme, a plant or other things in the garden. There's a lesson in there. They're short. So every morning with your cup of coffee, you could read a couple of essays and just really be sort of inspired, I think.
They don't lecture ever.
No.
It's osmosis. You absorb. Yeah. In the words in the literature, here's the couple of phrases that I love. He talked about the exhilarating misery of building a new house, which is a great way to put it. And he talked about a gypsy trunk of plants that they had, which just is great poetry and
it really
sets the stage for what they do there.
It really does indeed. So very much look forward to speaking with Joe Eck about Our Life in Gardens. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
My three favorite fall perennials are coming together. And you know, you have them too, I'm sure. The Lespediza, mm-hmm. the Beautyberry, and the Fireworks Solidago. Mm-hmm. So you have the beautiful pea shrub, the Lespediza with the purple flowers, the Beautyberry with its bright, shiny purple berries, and then that gold Fireworks Solidago.
You know what I love together?
It's cool.
Gold Fireworks Solidago with salvia black and blue.
Oh, yeah.
It's beautiful.
That would be too, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got them in different places. I'll have to move mine now, you got me. Encouraged to
but
do
that yellow and then that purple and black, and it's just really
and
pretty.
And they're kind of arching, beautiful plants.
Yeah. Exactly.
About the Wish You State, what's up?
I am getting, it was such a good season this year, really,
oh,
and things still look so pretty.
I know.
Mixed border wise. And I'm starting to feel a little greedy, like I need to add some more, you know. I mean, honestly, the beds are pretty full, but I want to start, I just need to do some more investment.
Yeah.
And fall is a great time to do that investment, isn't it? Particularly because plants are on sale.
Yes, they are.
And with the fabulous summer we've had and these cool temperatures, you can get some great herbaceous perennials on sale. Mm-hmm. And you can plant them now, and they will be coolly established before winter rolls around in any significant way. And they will be ready to go in all of their new life come spring. If you wait till spring, you can, your plants are at a slight disadvantage. Yeah. You get it in now, and you are going to be good to go when everything pops.
Funny you mention that, because I saw combinations in Ireland. I'm just dying to try.
Get on it, man, you know?
I know. Yeah. It's been a great season for sure.
So, if you want to start perennial gardening, I mean, same thing goes for tree, woody plants, shrubs, trees.
Anything.
Right now is an absolute fabulous time
I
to
agree.
Plant. All right. Calendar. Speaking of which, you can find some plants on sale, right?
Yeah. Gene Bush, the Munchkin Nursery, really a real asset to Southern Indiana. He's got his fall sale going on. He's got things from 10 to 45% off from now, it looks like September and October. It's up there in DePaul, Indiana. Always a great place to visit.
Great woodland plants, ephemerals, all kinds of neat native.
He's the guy.
Shady types of characters.
He and she's the guy. I don't want to leave out his
Yes, wife. Absolutely. Coming up to the 10th Annual Healthy Foods Local Farms Conference, which is going to be in Louisville again this year. They're going to do two things on Friday, Bob, November 6th. They're going to have a bus tour of different school gardens, which is pretty cool. And then Saturday, November 7th, is the actual conference that you'll attend. It's hosted by the Sierra Club, of course, and it's going to take place at Strickler Hall at the University of Louisville. For more information, you can go to healthyfoodslocalfarmsconference.org or, of course, check out our website at wfpl.org. It's a great conference, interesting people, great networking. The registration, I think, closes at the end of September. So if you're interested in going to that, check out the details so you can get registered before they close. Here's another cool thing too, Bob. Remember when we talked to Kathy Wheeler about the bourbon red turkeys?
Yep.
She's sending out the reminder that you can reserve your Heritage Bourbon Red Turkey now if you want it for Thanksgiving.
Does it come pre-cooked?
No, it does not. Come yeah. on.
You have to cook it. Okay.
Yeah, I got to cook. And that's not that hard. And anyway, you don't have to worry about that. But no. If you are interested in Heritage Bourbon Red Turkey, you can place your orders now. Kathy Wheeler at Star Farm Bourbon Red Turkeys. Don't forget, Thanksgiving's not too far away.
And speaking of stars, we have Joe Eck and Wayne Winterode, two legendary Vermont gardeners, will be at UDEL today at 3 p.m. for a talk. And later on in the show, we're going to have Joe Eck talking about the new book.
Right now, we're going to have Joe Eck talking about the new book.
The magic of radio.
That's right. So we get a little preview because Joe Eck is, in fact, joining us now, Bob. He's the co-author with his partner, Wayne Winterode, of Our Life in Gardens. It's a part memoir and part gardening book, a collection of essays that includes chickens, considering annuals and biennials, pondering the true meaning of hardiness, how to get an agapanthus to bloom, which I'm interested in, and the challenge of keeping track of one's favorite tool. Joe, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's nice to be with you.
Great. I think the last time we spoke with Wayne, and this time we get you, so we're delighted. Let's start. You guys have been in Vermont for 30-ish years. So
yes.
Can you tell us about the decision to move to Vermont, of all places, as gardeners,
Sure.
And then, give us a good feeling of North Hill, your farm and garden there.
All right. Well, we were both living in Boston, and both of us, neither of us are New Englanders, but both of us were in love with New England, with its landscape and its politics and its high culture. And so we knew we were going to stay in New England, and we knew we had to live in the country. We have an abiding passion for animals. We must have 300 on the farm at the moment, basically all pets. And we also knew we wanted to make a garden, and a real garden, a big garden, a garden that focused on woody plants, on trees and shrubs, more than herbaceous plants. So we looked about. Vermont was just awfully appealing. It's a very beautiful state. The mountains are really extraordinarily beautiful. And Pete's politics was sublime. In the early 70s, when we came here, it had the best environmental laws in the country, and of course it still does. And in many other ways, it just seemed like the right place to go. In terms of gardening, people were fairly discouraging.
It gets really cold there in the winter.
It gets really cold here, and many of our friends from Boston, particularly Gary Kohler at the Arnott Arboretum, said, "Oh, don't go there. You can only grow mosses and lichens." But we were not convinced of that. We thought that there was much that we could do if we provided things the right kinds of conditions.
And I think
so. Here we came, and here we are.
All right,
30-some years later.
Well, Joe, one of the many great things about your book is the personal stories you bring into it. And you had a little episode in Vermont with a realtor named Stubb Burnett who rode around in a moped.
Yes.
I just got this mental image of this guy found your place on a moped. What a wonderful part of your life story it is.
He was a charming man, absolutely charming. Of course, eccentricity is sort of the hallmark of Vermont. he took us one April afternoon, April the 30th, I'll never forget the date, to a perfectly remarkable piece of property with great ancient hardwoods, 100-year-old trees everywhere, a marvelous stream, a magnificent 10-acre meadow, and a forest carpeted in Viola rotundifolia. Just magic. We bought it on the spot.
Huh. And $500 an acre to boot.
That's a deal. So that's North Hill.
That is North
Hill. So what would we see at North Hill today?
A very different place.
Yeah.
We had to clear much land to make the garden. We had to thin the woods, which we did. And by thinning the woods, I mean taking down 3/4 of the standing timber. And we had to cut meadows where there were no meadows, and that meant taking down all the standing timber.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had to build the structures of a garden. We had to plant a frame, we had to establish pathing, we had to build walls, and we had, of course, to plant. And plant we did. Sometimes I walk through this garden and I think, I dug a hole for every one of these plants.
Yeah.
And, of course, Wayne did all the stonework. Mm-hmm. And sometimes often I marvel at that, because the whole garden is threaded through with fieldstone pathing, and mm-hmm. the whole garden is surrounded with stone walls, every stone of which Wayne hefted into place.
Wow.
It was the work of many, many decades.
Yeah,
another theme in your book is the we factor, that you guys did this together, and Gina and I both are kind of creating places with our spouses or significant others also. So talk about the we factor, how two people can indeed build a paradise together in Vermont.
Well, you know, we are really a pretty intense we. We've been together now 42 years. We are really awfully fond of each other. We have a lot of fun in each other's company, and we have common passions. I think the great luck of that was in part that we came together as quite young men. And, you know, at that point in your early 20s, when you're sort of making yourself up, and we made ourselves up together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a happy life.
Mm. There's a simpatico about it for sure. And I think Our Life in Gardens, the book, expresses that. I so enjoyed reading the book, Joe, because it chronicles more or less, I guess, like a little bit of a memoir / real gardening book with real information in it. Do you know what I mean? So it's not just the story of you all by any means, but let's kind of start from the beginning. You had said that, you know, you all knew that you wanted to move out to the country. One of the things was the fact that you love animals, and I love the story of sort of how all that began for the two of you when you were still living in a great apartment in the city, but you know, I thought, oh yeah, you brought some chickens home from the poultry show, built a little coop outside for them, perhaps,
no,
but no, indeed, you did not.
We didn't have any outside. We were living on Beacon Street in Boston,
uh-huh.
and the apartment was indeed magnificent. We bankrupted ourselves for the pleasure of living there for a year,
uh-huh.
but no, we built a coop in the living room, and tucked the chickens into it, and uh-huh. I guess. It would have been okay if we'd stopped at 3, but of course, once we've got a couple of anything, we tend to collect it.
And I noticed that, yes.
There we were, out visiting chicken shows every weekend and buying more chickens, and oh, we even bought a pair of pheasants at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And so after 9 months, we thought we had better look for a country place.
So at this point, are you all starting to study garden design, or is this something that just kind of followed in a not so organized fashion?
We have no formal training in horticulture or design at all. Wayne's
all practical.
Wayne's degree is in Renaissance literature, mine's in philosophy.
Okay, so all practical.
But you know, we read. We've
mm-hmm.
we've always read, and you can learn anything if you read.
Right. So, no, you're right. Yeah.
Well, I keep thinking, like, my wife and I have different tastes in plants and in gardening. We work together pretty well most of the time. Do you guys have different tastes and things? You somehow meld, or
we have an absolute universal affection for every plant on the planet.
Oh, that takes care of that.
So that's it, right? Your minds are far more open than most of us when it comes to plants, huh?
We love plants.
That's too easy.
Yeah.
And that has made it easy. I mean, the only difficult thing has been making the garden big enough to accommodate our passions.
Uh-huh.
And it is pretty big. But no, we have a communality of taste that, again, as I said earlier, I think is the consequence of having invented ourselves as a couple.
Mm-hmm. So the book is organized basically in different essays, if you will, that both you and Wayne wrote. And, you know, we can't go through all of them, but let's pick out a couple of them to consider. Eating, I'm just jealous over the fact that you've got to eat fresh artichokes with Christopher Lloyd, a great dickster to begin with, right? But talk about, you'd said you guys have a hard time, you know, stop collecting plants. You have an experience, and then you want to make sure that you can bring that back to Vermont or try to do it yourself.
Yeah.
So let's talk about growing artichokes and eating them fresh in Vermont.
I've always been fond of them. I've eaten artichokes since I was a young adult, and my own family never ate them. But once I went off to college, I began to eat them, and I've always loved them. But you know, the artichokes you get in the markets or are shipped from California, and sometimes they're not as fresh as they might be. One day at Great Dixter, which is the home and garden of our good friend Christopher Lloyd, we were having lunch, and Christo went out and picked fresh artichokes, and they really were extraordinary. They were nothing like what I'd been used to eating bought in the markets from California. So we decided to try to grow them ourselves, and Roger Swain, the great garden guru from the Victory Garden,
right,
a friend of ours, said, if you want to grow artichokes, you need to grow the variety called Imperial Star, because it has been tricked into functioning like an annual rather than a biennial, which means that you'll get artichokes the first year. So following his advice, we germinated Imperial Stars, sowed the seed in February, planted the plants out in May, and indeed got wonderful artichokes, and we've grown them every year ever since. Uh-huh. Interestingly enough, we have introduced them to several gardens in Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
Peggy Fowler out in Smithville grows them and grows them very successfully. Stephen Riley and Emily Bingham grow them very successfully out on their farm in Henry County, and Sissy Nash grows them successfully.
So it can be done.
It can be done. It's actually rather easy.
And you were just commenting on how certain things literally are best eaten as freshly picked as possible, including corn.
Yeah, it's
and
true
artichokes.
Of everything. I mean, we all know that.
Yeah.
There's nothing like corn picked and popped into the pot right away. But you know, even carrots, if you pull them up out of the earth and they have that rich, earthy smell, and you take them in and eat them right away, and it really is a very different experience from eating something that's been in a market for a while.
Yeah, Joe, speaking of it can be done, you guys almost went out of your way to grow things you wouldn't think of in Vermont. Agapanthus, bananas, the bay tree, and I think I read in an earlier book you have a big bunch of gunnera growing up there in Vermont.
Yes.
So was that a deliberate thing? Hey, we can do this in Vermont whether you like it or not?
I think all gardeners are pushing the limits always. I mean,
right,
you always want to grow what people say you can't grow. And if you have a reasonable measure of success at that, you keep doing it. I must be honest with you and tell you the gunnera experiment failed.
Ah.
we went to a great deal of trouble, and they came through a couple of winters, but they were never the gunnera of our dreams, so we took them away.
But the more you try, the more chances at success, right? So,
absolutely.
So keep trying. Well, and like that kind of, I was fascinated because the measures that you guys will go to meet with some of these successes as well, the camellia and the winter garden, and it's not like, ooh, a winter garden and you plant plants that are going to be enjoyed in winter. No, Joe and Wayne built concrete, you know, walls and protection and all this sort of thing. Talk about some of the different, I guess, extremes, if you will, that you guys have gone to in order to have some of these fabulous plants permanently.
Well, we do have greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that I couldn't imagine not in having in a climate like Vermont, because it does get awfully dark and cold here for an awfully long part of the year. And we have three greenhouses. We have that wonderful winter garden off the kitchen, in which we grow camellias and tender rhododendrons, and where we stand a lot of the tender edible plants. We bring our big bay tree into there in the winter. And we have a greenhouse given over entirely to camellias. It's only camellias. We call it the Camellia House. And we have about 35 or 40 camellias in there. And then we have a largish greenhouse at the far western end of the garden, which really functions like a conservatory. But there we keep our citrus. We pick our own fresh limes and lemons all winter long. We never buy them. We grow them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another funny thing you mentioned was agapanthus. You thought at first you had to break the clay pot to get it out.
You know, Bob, that was a really interesting lesson for us, because we typically would divide our agapanthus. Your listeners may not know this, but agapanthus have very, very aggressive root systems, and they quickly fill up a pot. Right. They press strongly against the pot walls, and it's very hard to get them out of the pot if you have to repot them. Usually we'd smash the pots, which is pretty painful with a $30 clay pot.
Yeah.
But one year, a couple of years ago, we decided to divide the agapanthus after we had refrained from watering them for a couple of weeks. And they slipped right out of the pot ever so easily. Mm-hmm. So a lesson learned. You know, one of the lovely things about gardening is that it is filled with 100,000 little tricks and clevernesses that you acquire over the course of a lifetime. And these great old gardeners, these old estate gardeners whom you sometimes meet, they know so much. And you know, Wayne and I are getting along in years, and we're beginning to realize we know a few things.
Indeed.
It's not all plants in your book either, Joe. You wrote a wonderful ode to the trowel.
Oh, those are marvelous trowels. The trowels that we prefer are called nurseryman's trowels, and they're heavy forged steel and with great wooden handles. They last forever, absolutely forever. They're quite powerful digging instruments. We get them from a marvelous company called A.M. Leonard, which is up in Ohio. They're a mail-order horticultural supply company, and they carry them. They're not terribly costly. They're about $12 a piece, I think. And really, one trowel will last a decade, at least a decade.
And your favorite place to keep them, which I was sort of delighted, is stuck in the ground. My husband gets mad at me if I leave my spade or my garden fork stuck in the ground, because he wants to know where it is, and then if it starts to rain, I get in trouble. So I can now say that you all keep your trowels out in the ground by the shed.
We put them at the entrance to the back garden path. We always know where they are, and I can keep my eye on the number. We're quite stern with everyone who works with us, that they must put their trowel back at the end of the day.
That's the key. I wondered how you'd...
Back into the ground where it belongs.
Mine's in the ground, but it's out in the back 40.
Oh.
Yeah, Joel, there's a very poignant ending to your book, something I think about more and more, because my wife and I have spent 30 years creating something, and as Janine and Andy are doing at their place. The future, you know, we're going to die. What's going to happen to all this work and all these plants? And you mentioned a couple instances where friends lost their whole garden. One watched it being bulldozed up, which would bring me to tears, I think.
We think this garden has a lifetime pretty much co-equal with our own. I don't see it going beyond us. It's not really a candidate for the Garden Conservancy, because we are not wealthy enough to leave a large endowment to sustain it. So I think it's going to be over. We hope that the plants will be disseminated and, you know, will be loved and cherished by other serious gardeners, but this garden is the work of our lifetime, and I think it will live our lifetime, and that's all.
I think that that's a good way of looking at it, and you express it, I think, in a different sort of way, too. Like, your love of gardening is so clear in this book, and you state that you would never consider leaving that place, North Hill.
Never.
And maybe that allows for more devotion now to a place, not constantly worrying about what the future is after you're gone, right?
Well,
living in the moment.
Yes, yes. It's certainly true that we enjoy our moments here now very much.
And you said something, too, that I think is probably the best definition of a true gardener that I've ever heard. If the management of any garden does not fall into a rhythm of comfortable routines, there will not be a garden at all, but only an embarrassment and a reproach. So comfortable routines is the key, I think.
Absolutely. And again, I go back to my dear friend, Sissy Nash.
Yeah.
I mean, I've known Sissy now for 20 years, and her routine is to get up in the morning and have her breakfast and go out into the garden and work.
Yeah.
And she has a beautiful garden in consequence.
Absolutely.
So I think that's true always. Gardens are a discipline, they're a labor, they're a love. One must be faithful to them.
But a comfortable routine caps it off.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe, so much. We appreciate
it. Thank you.
You're most welcome.
Joe Eck is the co-author, along with his partner Wayne Winterroad, of the book Our Life in Gardens. They live, work, and garden in Vermont at their farm, North Hill, and do garden design work for clients across the country. Joe Eck and Wayne Winterroad will be in Crestwood, Kentucky at Udell Gardens for a book signing and lecture later today, September 13th at 3 p.m. And of course, for more information about this, please visit our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up, I visit the JFK Arboretum in Ireland and the Kennedy Homestead nearby. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill. Continuing my marvelous tour of Ireland, and of course, there's no more famous name in American politics than Kennedy. And as it turns out, there's a JFK Arboretum about 100 miles south of Dublin near New Ross. It's a marvelous place. It's about 650 acres, and it comes with a great story of its beginnings and its heritage and what's here and where it's going. And to help us get through all this, I'm going to speak with Mairead Carbra, who's information officer at the JFK Arboretum here in New Ross, Ireland. Mairead, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you so much. Really nice to meet you, and I look forward to just having our little chat.
That we will. We just spent about 2 hours walking around the Arboretum. It's just an incredible place. And being the Irish weather, it rained for a while, then it would stop, then it was bright sunshine, then it was kind of gray and gloomy, then it picked up again. But that's all part of the culture here in the island. Speaking of which, let's get some history first of you. How did you get into plants, and what brought you here to this wonderful JFK Arboretum?
Well, as an Irish person, trees are very much a part of our culture, our heritage. And we've always had a respect for trees in Ireland. And my own family, which we're truly Irish, my name is Carbra, and it goes right back. So I've always, from I can remember, I've loved trees. Now, I spent some time working in Canada back in the early 80s, and I've also spent some time working in South America, in Chile. And again, I became accustomed with many other types of trees and realized how much I really did like trees.
And the JFK Arboretum itself, give us some background on how it got here, and then really, more importantly, why it got here.
Well, shortly after the death of President Kennedy, a number of Irish Americans approached the Irish government to look at the idea of some kind of memorial to the late president. They came up with $100,000 at the time, which was probably quite a lot. And the Irish government, in conjunction with those people, put their thinking caps on and came up with the idea of an arboretum. Now, an arboretum, as distinct from a park, is dedicated to research and education as well as recreation.
We shouldn't forget, of course, that the Kennedy clan emigrated to the United States from this very area in Ireland in the 1840s.
That's right. And when the government with the Irish Americans were looking at where to have the memorial, there was no better place than to look at New Ross in County Wexford, which was the original county of the Kennedy clan. And just about 5 kilometers from here is the Kennedy Homestead, which is dedicated to the memory of the Kennedy family and has a lot of memorabilia. And we work very closely with the homestead. In actual fact, you can actually see from our Slieve Culture, which is our viewing point, you can look down in down on the homestead.
And as luck would have it, this is Heritage Week in JFK and across the country of Ireland, really. And it all ties in together what we're doing here at the Arboretum, because heritage is so important. And today, rather than talk a lot about tree botany and that kind of thing, which is interesting, of course, to many people, we're going to talk plant stories, because the Irish tell stories as well as anybody in the history of the world. And many of these old Irish trees and plants come with great stories. And so Mairead is going to go down the list here of plants that they have here and tell us some stories about their backgrounds.
Just over the weekend, we did some work here at the Arboretum with young children, and very much in my mind is some of the experiences I had with the children as we talked and introduced them to the trees, so that they saw something more than just timber, that they actually could relate and see the spirit of the trees. So we looked at the aspen, which is our native poplar tree. It shakes it trembles, as its name is the Populus tremula. It means the trembling poplar. But it, in Irish lore, it's considered, also in Scottish lore, it's considered to be the shameful tree, the tree that offered its timber up for the cross that crucified Jesus. It also, this is particularly Scottish, it reckoned that while all other trees bowed their head while Jesus was on the way to Calvary with the cross, the aspen held its head up high, and ever since it has been shaking in shame. So that's one of the, and it's a symbol of death in Irish lore as well. So it's probably quite linked to that story that grew up around the aspen. But its little leaves shake in the slightest breeze. And when I was working with the children, I was telling them about this. And I said, now, you know, if you just listen for a minute, you'll hear it rustling in the breeze. And just at that moment, the whole tree with thousands of leaves began to rustle. And just as it started, it just ended in silence. And the children were just so thankful. They actually were heard to whisper, "Thank you, tree."
Well, thank you, tree. What a great story. Another one equally intriguing in that is the hawthorn. Tell us about that one.
Oh, yes, the hawthorn, or as we call it, is familiarly known here in Ireland as the fairy bush or the may bush. Now, we have a number of stories about the hawthorn. One of them relates back to famine times when, I mean, we have the saying, it's used quite a lot here in Ireland, the saying, "When all fruit fails, welcome haw." Now, if you know the haw, and particularly from the Irish hawthorn, it's a tiny red berry with a stone quite as large as the berry itself, with very little flesh on it. But during the famine times, which is back in 1846-47, the Irish people lived off the fruit of the hawthorn. And since we use "when all fruit fails, welcome haw." Now, going back to more spiritual nature, we have what we call the fairy bush or the fairy tree. Now, the particular one that we have here in the Arboretum that we talked about this morning has survived because originally the Arboretum here was the working farm owned by the Gifford, Reverend Gifford, and then was handed on to a Doyle family. Now, when the Arboretum was initiated, a lot of the trees or a lot of the land had to be planted, and there were trees that were, well, in the wrong place, let's say, and the workmen were ordered to cut down those trees. But one of those that survived was the hawthorn, because in our myth and legend, we have it that if a lone hawthorn tree is cut down or is damaged in any way, the fairy folk will haunt you, and that's mild forevermore. I mean, stories have gone that even if twigs of branches that were used to make bedding for cattle or to feed cattle from the leaves, the cow that lived off the leaves or lay down on the bed, they died. And it has been known that if those branches were brought back to the position of the hawthorn tree, the cattle survived, or they were reborn, let's say.
Well, I've got two hawthorn trees at home. I'm not going to touch them. I don't want the little people messing with me. Now, we talked, there's a bunch of, like, the oak tree and the birch tree. They come with different backgrounds, and there's a lot of beautiful birches here, but that's called, well, you tell me what the birch is and the oak and so forth in Irish history.
Yes, well, the oak tree is called the noble of the wood. It's noble because of it's regarded a tree of dignity, its strength, its endurance. So it symbolizes endurance and dignity for the Irish people, and naturally it's our native tree. And many of our towns, lands, and our places are named after the oak tree. Let's say we have where I originated myself back in County Longford. Dhurachán is the Irish word for the oak tree. Also, County Derry, Dhura, Kildare. You may be familiar with Bridget of Kildare. That's Kill, the church of the oak. Trees are so important that our place names, and very often as well our family names would come from names of trees.
Now the birch tree, that's the lady. Well, again, you tell me about the birch.
Yeah, the birch tree, or the beh, is as it's called in Gaelic. It's regarded as the lady of the woods. And it's quite interesting in that just recently Eunice Shriver died, but she has planted a birch tree, as has Jean Kennedy Smith, just outside the Arboretum on their visit here. So they chose well, lady of the wood.
And there's the biggest mahonias I think I've ever seen anywhere growing here, and they're named for a man from Ireland, as it turns out.
Yes, a Mr. McMahon, who was a well-known horticulturalist, emigrated in about 1796 to Philadelphia and discovered the mahonia. And okay, from the name McMahon, it's got its name.
And the yew tree, they have some monster yews. Again, we think of yews as foundation plants for our houses in the States, but the yews also come with a story. It's a very Irish tree, as it turns out, or shrub.
It is indeed, and many of our yew trees that grow in Ireland come from one ancient yew from County Fermanagh. And again, place names like Iona, that gets its name from the yew tree. They were always considered as being placed in and around churchyards or on graveyards, and people felt for quite a while it was commonly understood that it was because they were poisonous and the farmers didn't allow the cattle eat them. But it was simply because they were the marking places of the burial grounds of famous people, as famous as in chieftains back in olden times, or kings. It marked the spot where they were buried. So they would have got their speciality from that.
And the climate here at the JFK Arboretum allows for a lot of plants I wish we could grow in Louisville, but they just don't do well in Louisville. Among them, there's a huge grove of eucalyptus here, and the bark is pretty special about that. Tell us about the eucalyptus and how the fire is a part of its life cycle.
Yes, in traveling around the Arboretum through the eucalypts, you can see that the bark peels off in large sheets from the eucalypt trees. And over the years, they have accustomed themselves to the bushfires in Australia. As the fires, you know, fire moves fast and furious, but what does it do? It catches the loose bark and moves very fast, so the tree survives. But it also, the tree, having adapted itself over the years, its little capsules, as you know, of the eucalypts, are quite difficult to open, and they need the fire. It's the fire, the heat from the fire opens and allows propagation, as does, while it burns the loose bark, it facilitates new growth on the trunk of the tree also. So it is incredible how nature, and we think that it's just timber, in actual fact, they're very spiritual beings, just as we are.
And you've got a tree here that was just only found in 1995 in Australia, the Wollumi. I'm not pronouncing it right. I'll let you pronounce it and give its history, because I can't get it out.
Well, I'm not so sure I've got the right pronunciation, but it's, from what I know, it's the Wollumi nobilis. And just like the Mahonia, getting its name from its founder, the Wollumi nobilis gets its name from a guy called Noble, who was out with a group of, I won't say tourists, but people obviously interested in trees, way out in the bush in Australia, and discovered this strange-looking tree that hadn't been known since the time of the dinosaurs. It's the same family as the Araucaria, and it took many years for him to really discover that this tree had possibly been growing, or let's say its seeds were probably buried for many, many, many millennia, and then all of a sudden appeared. So ever since, we have three species here in the Arboretum. As they belong to the Australian government. They are really worried that they will ever disappear again. So they're ensuring that, you know, the world has a selection of the wallaby.
And that's part of the mission here at the JFK Arboretum. They evaluate trees, planting from all over the world, and they have different places, the northern North America, eastern North America, from Australia, just all over there, and then they plant them out and evaluate.
Yes, that's right. Well, the little trip we took this morning took us round through the family plots, which is basically where trees are laid out with loads of space with which to grow for the canopy, the root, etc. And they're generally planted in groups of three. And we did say earlier about, okay, the one to grow, one to die, and one to be stolen. But as opposed to that, we have part of the Arboretum is dedicated to research. And we have sections and each continent represented by different plantings in forest plots. So from time to time, they are thinned out and evaluated. And that is part of the work of the gardeners here at the Arboretum.
And there's two trails there. One's red and one's yellow. And the yellow trail, you can get on a horse-pulled cart led by a man who knows quite a bit about the trees and so forth, and ride around for an hour or so. And, of course, the inner trail, the red trail we took today, you can walk around and see a lot of these things up close and personal. It's just it's a marvelous place. And at the very top of this arboretum, above the tree line, is it's one of the most fascinating places in Ireland. You can see five counties, they say, from up there. Talk about what it's like to go to the top of the JFK Arboretum.
Well, it is a wonderful place to go depending on the weather. If you want to get the cobwebs blown from your brains, you can go on a real windy day. Or if you want to be in the clouds, go on one of the famous Irish days, misty days, soft Irish rain, etc. But on a day like today, we were very lucky in that we had showers, but we also had some really bright sunshine with just some really nice cloud formation. But when you go to the top, it's about 900 feet high, not very much given the mountains you have in your neck of the woods, but for us it's kind of high, and particularly if you have to run up. Now, we didn't run up the hill, but anyway, you get a view of five other counties. You can see Wicklow, up to the Wicklow Mountains, right around to the Sleaf Blooms over in Offaly and Carlow, right around to Kilkenny and Tipperary and back to Waterford. And also, you can see all of County Wexford. It is the most wonderful place to visit. And generally, when we take also the yellow trail that we generally take coach tours around. But as part of the coach tour, we go up to the viewing point, which is on the top of Sliabh Caolte, which means the mountain of woods. And generally, people feel that that has made their holiday, regardless of what part of Ireland they've been. When they go to the top of Sliabh Caolte, of course, on a fine day, it makes their holiday. So if you're ever coming to Ireland, do visit Sliabh Caolte and the Arboretum.
Well, tell us about the plants you'll see and feel and be able to touch on the top of the mountain up there.
Yes, we have many heathers. We have the firs, or the whin, as it's also called, and that's very thorny. And we have a lot of nesting birds up there also. Given that there aren't trees right up on the top, they're very low-growing shrubs. But just at this time, it's a blaze of purple and gold. And our local hurling and football teams have chosen the colours purple and gold. And they do say, if you travel around County Wexford, you will see purple and gold on all of the hilltops. It is magical.
And then finally, you know, the Kennedy name remains large in much of the United States, and the people still have strong feelings, I think, for the family and the Arboretum, certainly, here in Ireland.
Yes, indeed. And just last week, as part of the tribute to Eunice Shriver, we had the Book of Condolence here. And the comments made was, it just gave us an idea of how well respected the family is. And very popular in this area.
Mairead Carbre is Information Officer at the JFK Arboretum in New Ross, Ireland. For more information on the Arboretum, or to see the many pictures I took of the Arboretum, visit our website at wfpl.com. www.ohmyheritage.org.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill with more Berry questions.
More Berry questions.
Berry good ones.
All right.
But since you're the Berry expert, I keep ducking them your way,
kiddo. All right. That's quite all right.
There's the first one.
All right.
From Tish and Steven.
Mm-hmm.
We have a thriving quince bush in our yard. It's currently bearing quite a bit of fruit. Can we eat it?
Yes.
Yes.
Quince.
Simple enough.
You can.
Next question.
Probably not really sweet, so you have to kind of sugar it up, sweeten it up. But quince is absolutely edible.
Quince jam.
Let's see. This one's from Barim Safiri. Barim asked Dr. Hill, dear Mr. Hill.
Doctor work.
I have 3 years old, healthy, well-grown blackberries.
Okay.
They bloom well every year, full of flowers. They don't see any disease on the leaves or flowers, but the fruit is extremely small and then it dries up. They did buy it from a reputable nursery, so they're wondering if we have any idea as to what's going on. And I know that you don't.
Well, I'm just guessing shade or lousy ground or something.
No, I think if they're growing well and flowering well, then they're probably getting plenty of sun.
Okay.
But I mean, think about other plants, too, like roses, when they flower, like mites, thrips, that sort of thing, can eat the flowers, and then what, the fruit sets, right? But it's damaged, and it shrinks up, or it's very small because it's been, you know, basically put at a disadvantage.
So what's the solution to this?
Well, you can check and see. In fact, you could use neem.
Neem.
You need to check and see if that indeed is the culprit, you know. You can put pieces of paper underneath and tap the plant to see if there's anything that falls there before you'd spray it.
Gotcha.
But the trickier side of it is that it could actually be anthracnose, which is a fungal disease.
Oh.
And the anthracnose can impact the plant in various ways, but one of them is through the flower and then impacts the developing fruit.
But the leaves would still look healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
So if that's the case, then you can do one of two things. First, I would try, make sure, Barim, that you cut back all the way to the ground all of the canes that flowered and fruited this year, because they're not going to do anything else anymore anyway.
Right.
Get rid of any potential disease that way right now. Do it right now. See what happens next year. If you still have this persistent disease, you likely, in fact, have a persistent disease and you need to get rid of the plants. Because you can't, I mean, there's nothing to do about most of those bramble diseases, unfortunately.
Gotcha.
So, there. Here's one more question, Bob. Okra. I like this one.
Oh, sitting on bleachers in this one, too. Yep.
Gumbo no go is the title of the message. Gumbo no go. Why on earth are the leaves of my okra always dropping off?
Well,
is the question.
Yeah.
Okra likes it hot, hot, hot. They like hot, high heat in the day, high heat in the night, and high soil temperatures.
All missing.
Thus, you could have like root decay disease, and if you have that, then all your leaves drop off.
That's it. Good deal.
Not hot enough.
If somebody out there has a question Bob can actually answer, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week is pretty back and forth.
Back and forth. It is, I guess.
To be specific.
Did you know that this is what it meant?
No.
Mutabilis.
I was surprised. I thought it kind of meant the opposite for some reason.
Mutabilis. Changeable, especially as to color.
Yeah.
Huh. Mutable, I guess.
Mutable, okay.
You know, I don't know.
I don't know.
So, for example, Aesculus mutabilis.
The chestnut.
Hibiscus mutabilis.
The Confederate rose.
Wow. Talked about hibiscus not too long ago.
Yeah.
Sort of rose mallow-like.
Uh-huh.
Hyptis mutabilis.
The tropical bush mint. Never tried that one.
Lupinus mutabilis.
Pearl lupins.
Pearl lupins.
Yep.
Phacelia mutabilis.
The changeable scorpion weed.
And don't you forget it.
No. No, no.
And Quercus mutabilis.
The oak.
Oak.
So they do change.
Changeable, especially as to color.
Exactly.
So variable, too, I would suspect.
Oaks can do that, yeah.
You know what I mean? All right, so if you see mutabilis, changeable, especially as to color, may be expected. How about that? Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us once again next week.
Homegrown is produced by the constantly helpful Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.